For the week of February 14th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 312, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Washington, D.C., I'm Michael Giltz.
Are you really in Washington, D.C.? I didn't know that.
Yes, I am. It will come out, by the time this podcast is out, so I might as well say it now. I am going to be the nominee for the Supreme Court. I just wanted you to know there will probably be press and reporters and all that sort of stuff. Just prepare yourself.
So you are basically the only person in the United States who is willing to take that nomination. Everybody else has declined.
No, there will be quite a few others ready to go.
Okay.
Of course, including Lin-Manuel Miranda, who would probably win if he was put up.
That's true. Now, I guess, do we need to say that one of the Supreme Court justices passed away?
No, you do not.
Okay, well, I just thought, for those outside the country, they may not be tracking.
We're having a constitutional crisis. We'll get back to you.
Just a small little problem in our country.
But in entertainment news, what will we discuss?
Well, on this week's show, this is one of my favorite shows, Michael. We're going to curse this week a lot.
What are you talking about?
Well, look, it worked for Deadpool. The superhero movie that transformed from a comeback vehicle for Ryan Reynolds to a box office hit to a phenomenon all in the space of 5 days. Deadpool wasn't the only movie news. In China, it was Golden Week, and another record was set, a box office record, one that tops even North America. Plus, the Oscars are getting closer and will report on the latest buzz thanks to the BAFTAs and the WGA. During Inside Baseball, we'll go behind the scenes at the Grammy Awards, and that's why this is one of my favorite shows of the year. Yes, it's time for our annual visit with David Wilde, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. He also works on the Grammys and other big TV specials. We're hoping to talk to him sometime later today. We've been tracking him down and we've been playing phone tags, so hopefully we'll reach him in time. He's going to take a few minutes from his busy schedule to dish the dirt on Rihanna's no-show, that microphone malfunction that flustered Adele, and how Kendrick Lamar's electric performance broke new ground. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. There are two big stories, and we're looking at the worldwide box office, not just North America. We get our info from Rentrak. We have a link in our show notes. We also pull information from the LA Times, the New York Times, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, you name it. And of course, the phenomenal number one film in the world is Deadpool, starring Ryan Reynolds, $260 million, which is about $200 million more than people expected.
That's true.
As of last Tuesday, this was an absolute... Should we just talk about Deadpool for a minute?
Sure, why not? You seem to be.
This set up every record. This is literally... let's go through the records. Where are they? It's the top R film opening of all time, even if you pull out that Thursday night gross, as I like to do, because movies don't open on Friday anymore. We're talking about opening weekend. Traditionally, that means Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Now movies open Thursday at 7 p.m. Well, it made $12 million on Thursday, which was a record for an R-rated movie. So even if you take that out, it still beats The Matrix, I believe, which was the last movie to hold the record for the top R-rated film opening of all time on a weekend. It's the top Fox movie opening of all time. And mind you, Fox is the studio that released 6 Star Wars movies, among others.
That is what shocks me right there. Yeah. That's the shock. And they distributed X-Men.
So, we'll get to the comic book world. It's the top February opening of all time. It's the top opening for a first-time director. It was the biggest opening weekend in Russian history. It beat Star Wars, which was just a week ago. And now it was the biggest IMAX 2D opening of all time. It wasn't in 3D, by the way. I should point that out. It really opens the door for harder-edged comic book movies. But let's keep in mind, this was appropriate for this property. We've had others like Watchmen, Kick-Ass, and The Punisher, and those made sense as R-rated movies as well. Deadpool worked because it was work. You don't want Spider-Man cursing. That doesn't work.
No, no. Yeah.
So you can't just throw in a lot of cursing. However,
what about on this show? Can we do it on this show? Just for
absolutely. Okay. So, but look at what they did here. It's the biggest X-Men universe debut of all time. So we have different universes. Disney now controls the Marvel universe, except that there are X-Men and some other stuff owned by others. Right?
And in which universe did the two black holes collide where the gravitational waves were measured?
Well, we proved Einstein's theory of relativity, the one final piece of the puzzle, yes.
Wait, you mean we weren't solving for Interstellar? I thought that was all about Interstellar.
It set a record there too, but no, seriously, it set the biggest opening weekend ever for in the X-Men world. That includes all the X-Men movies, including the sequels. It's the biggest Marvel solo film debut of all time. Bigger than Iron Man, bigger than, you know, Thor, bigger than Captain America. The only one that had a bigger opening for the first film in a series was The Avengers, and that had all the superheroes in it. It's bigger than the Spider-Man movies. It's the bigger opening weekend than any of the Spider-Man movies.
Adjusted for inflation, you know I had to ask that.
Yeah. But it's pretty recent, so I don't know, but probably. Biggest debut for a DC film for the first in a series.
Wait a second, is Deadpool a DC film?
No, I'm saying, but it beat all their movies too.
Okay, all right.
It's a Marvel movie.
I thought so.
Look at Superman and Batman. Batman set records almost every time it opens. And in fact, it's bigger than the first film in the Christian Bale Batman trilogy, Batman Begins.
So what you're saying is it had enough records to be nominated for a Grammy.
Good Lord.
Come on, because of the record? And
Now, we knew on Tuesday or Wednesday they were saying, oh, maybe 60 million. And the studio said, competitors were saying, oh, I don't know, it looks more like 70. And the studio was like tamping down. No, we think, about 60 million. They don't want to have people make such crazy predictions. Then come Thursday, then Friday, every day they kept, ratcheting it up what the movie was going to make here in North America and around the world. And it ended up making $135 million over the weekend and $151 million over the Thursday to Monday, because we have a holiday on Monday as well here in North America. So is this a case, again, of bad tracking?
Well, I think it's bad tracking. No, I think really what it is that the studio's
a good movie. Well, it's not bad tracking. It's a good movie.
Yes, it's a good movie released at the right time on a holiday weekend where they could actually, Sunday, they could actually get a full slate of showings that could be sold out. And quite honestly, I think the tracking that was being measured was purposefully not misleading, but they wanted to tamp down.
It was half of what they thought it was going to be. This was exponentially bigger than they expected. They weren't tamping down expectations. They had no idea in God's green earth it was going to make this money. Be the biggest, practically the biggest opening movie of all time in a comic book? Deadpool with Ryan
Reynolds?
Well, I
don't think they expected that, but they expected it to do more than 70.
This is just the world where word of mouth is now supercharged. It's turbocharged. People see a movie on Thursday night. They don't see it on Friday. They see it Thursday, and everybody knows on Friday that everyone who saw it was ecstatic. I mean, the fanboys I spoke to, they weren't like it was good. They were like, oh my God, this was good. They were crazy about it.
You talk to fanboys?
I do. Of course I do.
Unbelievable.
How I roll. A lot of doormen in New York City like comic book movies.
What are you doing talking to doormen?
Because I stay in different places, I'm couch surfing through New York, so I know a lot of doormen.
Okay.
But no, seriously, I think it's just a case of, the fact that word of mouth, good or ill, is just much quicker now. It doesn't take 2 or 3 weeks. It takes 2 or 3 hours. It used to be 2 or 3 days, 2 or 3 weeks, then 2 or 3 days. Now it takes 2 or 3 hours.
Well, that's the whole saying that Chris Aronson of Fox, he's the head of distribution at Fox, and several other heads of distribution have said. It used to be that if you had a certain number of stars in your movie and you spent, the production value was of a certain level, that you
can't do it anymore. Yeah, you're not going to get away with it.
Yeah, you'd make a certain amount. I mean, you might not be a huge hit.
On the opening weekend.
On the opening weekend,
yes. You could open a movie, put ads on TV. You got Harrison Ford. You're going to make something.
You're walking away with $10-15 million. Now, there's no bottom. There's literally no bottom. You can make literally nothing.
And when you make a really good movie, and it's the right movie with the right tone, and it appeals to an audience that, frankly, was probably getting tired of a comic book superhero movie every 5 minutes. I was, and now I'm ready to see this one.
That's true. I wasn't going to see it. Now I will.
It's not the biggest news of the week, though.
What?
I think historically, what matters more is what happened in China.
Well, that I agree with, because when you look at that what happened, and you're about to tell us, I know, when you look at what happened in China at the movie box office, you have to go, wow, actually, that's huge.
Yes, it's Golden Week, or was Golden Week in China. That's the Chinese New Year, and New Year's Day is a huge day for going to the movies, and it stretched into Valentine's Day. So it really was like a super golden week, I believe. I don't think it always hits like this. But so it was a huge week at the box office for China, equivalent to Christmas to New Year's here in North America. And in China, they had lots of big movies opening, and they set a world record. Not a Chinese record, but a world record. The single biggest box office week of all time. $548 million one week in one territory, $500 million. And that beat the North American record, which was set about 4 minutes ago from Christmas to New Year's when Star Wars was playing. That was $526 million. So they just edged it out by $22 million. But nonetheless, that's a huge accomplishment. That's more than the Chinese box office generated in an entire year just a decade ago. In 2006, the entire year in China's box office amounted to $327 million. This week, they beat that by 50%.
That's remarkable.
That's unbelievable. It's a world record. It's a Chinese record. And it's the wave of the future. And what movies did it? The number two movie around the world. Remember, Deadpool made $260 million. And number two is Mermaid, a Stephen Chow film. Good reviews, by the way. The trades here covered it, and they like it. It's got cheesy CGI, but it was expensive. It was a $60 million movie, and it grossed $109 million over the weekend. It's at $275 million since it opened. And number three is The Monkey King 2. I think people who listen to the show now are familiar with Journey to the West, the classic Chinese folktale. Think Robin Hood, think Snow White, whatever you want to think, it's bigger. But The Monkey King dominates pop culture. And this is a sequel to a movie that came out, I think, last year or the year before. It grossed $38 million. It's at $113 million and counting for the week. From Vegas to Macau 2. This is a Hong Kong Chinese action comedy, like a gambling flick. Chow Yun-fat, who starred in the original Monkey King movie, also stars in this movie, this sequel. It's Vegas to Macau 2. It grossed $36 million over the weekend. It's at $120 million in counting. And then there's Kung Fu Panda 3, which is frankly another American-Chinese co-production.
Well, it's open in China. That's what's important. It's playing in China right now, if I'm not
mistaken.
That's
right. It grossed $34 million over the weekend, and it's at $250 million worldwide and counting. So you're looking at like three, four movies. Mermaid's at almost $300 million. The Monkey King 2 is over $100 million. Vegas to Macau 2 is over $100 million. Kung Fu Panda 3 opened before Golden Week. But these movies are raking in the bucks.
You know what didn't rake in the bucks, and I think maybe a little disappointing? Zoolander. Much like I guess it came in fourth place here in North America.
No, it was bad. It was a flop.
Okay. Well, you know, first movie opened like right after 9/11. It was like the first movie out of the gate. And it was just like and I remember doing the interviews for this, and you could just tell like Ben Stiller.
Nobody wanted to talk.
Yeah, Ben Stiller was just like, oh, brother, what are we going to do? Right. I mean, we have to release the movie. We can't pull it. It's a comedy. Maybe people need to laugh now after such a horrible tragedy. Please go see my movie. And nobody went. And it became this cult classic on DVD. And they tried to make a sequel, and it just fell flat, I think.
Well, it made $24 million over the weekend. It cost $50 million to make. They're hoping it will do enough overseas. It's only in 21 territories that they won't, you know, that they're not going to lose money on it.
No.
But it's certainly, they were hoping to really rocket launch this movie. They waited so long after the first that, you know, it wasn't likely. But, you know, it was one of those movies you felt
years.
Like
15 years. 15 years.
Had
Come
built
on.
An audience with the first one, and that they would be ready to see a sequel and it would do a lot better than the original did. Well, that's certainly not the case here. How to Be Single. That's the other counter-programming movie to Deadpool. That grossed $26 million over the weekend worldwide. It's cheap to make, $38 million, so that may be okay. But again, nobody's, you know, laughing it all the way to the bank. And number eight, however, is The Revenant. Another $20 million over the weekend, poised perhaps to win at the Oscars. It did great at the BAFTAs over the weekend. It's at $360 million worldwide. Alvin and the Chipmunks, we almost forgot about it. It cost $90 million to make. It's now made $190 million worldwide. Still a ways away from actual clear-cut box office success, but it'll be a while before we see Alvin and the Chipmunks 5, yet they're still clawing their way up. You're going to get to $200 million.
Well, and think about it. That's what you're getting theatrically, which means that you're going to get percentages of that when you start hitting premium VOD and premium cable and all of these different platforms. So when you actually spin out the life of that movie, it's going to be profitable.
What Well, that's why studios keep making movies, even though they say most of them fail. Come on, give us a break. Make it for free.
Well, they don't qualify. They don't say most of them fail theatrically during their first run.
Nonetheless, when we talk about hits and flops, we try to keep in mind ancillary markets, but we're looking for movies that score out and out at the box office itself as an indication of how much more money it's going to make down the road. We don't expect these movies to actually cost them an arm and a leg, even if they sort of flop. Zoolander, nobody's going to lose their shirt over that movie. You know, it wasn't that expensive to make. It's made half of it already. It'll probably get to who knows what when all is said and done. We'll have to see, but you know. At number 10 is A Violent Prosecutor. This is the light crime drama from South Korea that we talked about last week. It made another $11 million over the weekend. It's at $54 million in counting. I'm still waiting for someone to announce the English language remake.
Same here. I mean, you see a movie make $54 million like that in one country.
In a very easily copyable style, you know, the storyline, the plot.
Yes. Well, I'm waiting.
At number 11 is Star Wars The Force Awakens. It helped set that record, North American record, in Christmas, and now it's been squashed by China, but it's still going along. $2 billion worldwide, thanks to another $10 million over the weekend. At number 12, we talk about movies that are profitable and are not. Dirty Grandpa, another $7 million. It's doubled its budget so far. It's made $60 million worldwide. It cost maybe, we don't really know, maybe $30 million to make. That's a wild guess, actually. So maybe on paper, or in real life, it's $20 million. Maybe, you know, De Niro said, call me on the back end. You know, who knows?
Well, but anyway, it's one of those movies where it's like, you know what? We dodged a bullet.
We're going to break it even. Ever happened.
Yeah, it wasn't a good movie. We ain't making a sequel.
Let's forget it ever happened. That's right. But really, seriously, when you look at Deadpool, that is just a remarkable success story. And when you look down at the North American box office, Michael Moore is used to big success stories with his documentary films. He set the bar so high that people are immediately branding his new film, Where to Invade Next, a flop, a huge flop. It's terrible.
Yeah, there's some issues going on with this film. First of all, he gave it to this company.
New company.
It's a brand new company that was started by two folks out of Radiant. And these were folks that had worked for Harvey Weinstein at the Weinstein Company / Radiant. This was the company that was releasing theatrically as well as VOD. So they were doing a lot of day and date releases. The heads of that company left all at once and said, look, we have funding. We're going to go start our own company. Or at least they said they had funding. And so Michael Moore gave them this film to release. But
I didn't give them. They paid for it. It was a business deal. But, you know, he went with them.
And they kind of were stumbling.
They dropped
a little
bit. Ball, perhaps.
Well, and he actually, he was going to go on a bus tour, and that kind of didn't happen, mainly because
He got sick. He went into the hospital. He has pneumonia.
That's right.
Yeah, no, he got seriously ill. He's in the hospital. So his media plans fell apart. It was a new company, but it opened on 300 screens, and it grossed $1 million in its opening weekend. I would like to point out that makes it one of the 150 highest grossing documentary films of all time. Of all the films in history, it is immediately in the top 150 just from its opening weekend.
Well, did it cost $1 million to make, do you think?
I don't have a budget for it, but I'm sure it didn't cost a lot. But Hollywood Reporter said it's a career low and compares the per screen average of this film opening on 300 screens to movies opening on 15 screens and 3 screens, which is a little bizarre since they know better. But of course, if you look at what his recent movies have made, you know, he had a huge spike up with Fahrenheit 9/11 and he's gone way back down again to more human levels. I mean, $19 million for a capitalism, a love story, is insane. That's an unbelievably big amount of money for a documentary film to make. Will this match that? I'm assuming not.
No, it's not going to match.
You know, it's not going to. But if you look at his career spike, I mean, it's clearly Roger and Me, Bowling for Columbine, Fahrenheit 9/11 at this insane peak, and then going right back down again. It's, you know, it's to be expected as long as you make them. But to say it's a disaster, you know, what's the budget? What's it going to end up at? And now you just have to have a new normal with Michael Moore where, you know, when it's a new theater company and he's sick, how much money can you expect to make? But I think there's another reason
why
this didn't quite register.
No awards love?
No, because it wasn't eligible. I don't believe it was done that way, but maybe I'm wrong. But I just feel like this is an optimistic movie. He's gone around Europe and said, hey, what's working for you? What's working? Look at these things we can do. This will work. That'll work. And it's all reasonable stuff when you look at how healthcare or how home caring for kids is done in this country. He's looking at positive examples around the world, and I think the mood is angry and distressed.
Yeah, just ask Donald Trump. He's going to make America great again.
I just think his finger was not on the button as far as what people are looking for. They're looking to be riled up. And this movie was a humorous, low-key, optimistic film. And I don't think that captures the tenor of the times. And perhaps that's why it didn't click with audiences.
Well, the movies that are clicking with audiences, at least some of those audiences, specifically the British audiences and the awards givers at the, you know, Writers Guild are, you know, they had their big awards ceremonies over the weekend. And it looks like The Revenant kind of, I don't want to say, well, I guess he did. It did sweep, didn't it?
At the BAFTAs, it did. Yes.
Yeah.
The BAFTAs.
Well, I know. Hey, you know what? I've got to get my old friend Charles Randolph on the phone and at least congratulate him. I mean, they won the WGA award. They won the BAFTA award. They are winning so many awards for best adapted screenplay for The Big Short.
That's right. Well, that looks like those look like real, you know, strong bets for Oscar. You know, that's my pick. That the best adapted short and the best original screenplay will both go to those movies, Spotlight and The Big Short.
Well, I think for best adapted screenplay, the reason it will win that is because it's their way of kind of awarding that film, because there's also a director who wrote that film, and they don't have to, then they can discount Adam McKay as a director, or they don't discount, but they feel like they've
He's not nominated.
I thought he was nominated for best director.
He's nominated for best director?
I think so.
I forgot.
And so they can say,
sorry,
well,
Adam,
we gave you an award, best adapted screenplay. So usually the person,
you know, people think of that they go through their list like that. And I don't know if they do that so much. I think they just say, you know what? That was a really hard book to turn into a movie.
Yeah.
A movie about, you know, blood sucking Wall Street people profiting from the biggest collapse in Wall Street history.
Pretty much, yeah. And how do we explain it? Yeah,
and you know, and that's not how they are in real life. Of course, they're actual people, and the book humanized them and showed all the lunacy around them and made it interesting and fascinating. The movie, you know, successfully captured that as far as box office and critics are concerned. So I think it was just a particularly challenging book to turn into a movie. I guess that's how they see it, and so they're saying there. Yeah, I don't think they said, well, we're not going to give you director. They were never going to give him director, right?
Well, they nominated him.
That's right.
So maybe
happen, but that's the WGA awards. And in the movies at the BAFTAs, The Revenant swept. And frankly, the awards, you could see the Oscars going this way up and down the line. Best picture, director, actor, cinematography, sound, The Revenant. Best actress, Brie Larson. Best actor, DiCaprio, of course, like we just said. Best supporting actor, Mark Rylance. Best supporting actress, Kate Winslet. You know, it's just best score, Ennio Morricone. You know, the BAFTAs are not lockstep with the Oscars. They don't have enough of a history for that. But boy, this year, it feels like you're getting a preview in a big way.
Well, yeah, I don't know about Mark Rylance. I mean, I would love to see him win because he
you think Stallone's going to win?
I don't know. I think maybe Stallone's win was being nominated in the first place. But,
well, then who do you think is going to win?
What is it? Mark Ruffalo is also nominated.
Oh, for Spotlight.
Yeah, and so that might be the, hey, we gave Spotlight an award. Look, we gave it to Mark Ruffalo. So.
I'm hoping Spotlight wins Best Picture, frankly. I don't think it's clear yet. I mean, the BAFTAs have some people They have some people in common with the people who vote for the Oscars, but it's not, you know, it's not a given that because they favored The Revenant. Again, the three major guilds all split.
That's true.
And the Hollywood Reporter, the Variety, had a good breakdown of how they vote and pick those people, because the Producers Guild, I believe, mimics the way the Oscars go.
In what way?
You know, they do the weighted ballot thing. They do the same exact system. And if you assume that they reflect the Oscar voters at large, then that would make their pick more likely to be the accurate one. And that was The Big Short. And the actors picked Spotlight, and the directors picked The Revenant. The directors picked the movie with the hardest shoot. Presumably, the actors picked the movie with the biggest, broadest cast, and the producers picked the movie that was probably a bear to make and convince people, hey, let's make a movie about Wall Street. So, you know, they're all voting the way you would expect them to vote, in a sense. So I still think it's a pretty wide open race.
Then what you're saying, if I can get this, maybe I'm just interpreting it wrong or rightly, you tell me, but you're saying if The Revenant, it swept the BAFTAs, but it's still not a big deal.
Segue.
You're not supposed to point them out, okay?
Then don't do them so obviously.
All right, well, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, is there any way we can get Adele here on Showbiz Sandbox? We promise not to drop a mic on our piano, okay? We promise. I'm pretty sure our ratings would spike if we could do that. It worked for late night host James Corden. His running bit of driving in a car and doing karaoke with celebrity guests is a signature skit for the show, and boy, I love it, by the way. And when Adele joined in, it went through the roof. The YouTube clip has already hit more than 67 million views, and no, this time around, unlike Adele's video for Hello, Michael wasn't one of the first 23 or even the first 23,000 to watch it.
Rub it in.
Well, per The Hollywood Reporter, The Late Show with James Corden YouTube channel has amassed more than 630 million views and 3.1 million subscribers since the show premiered on March 23rd, 2015. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's, you know, how much money do they make off this? It'd be a big deal if they raked in a lot of money. What's the dollar amount that they make off this? We don't ever hear. More people subscribe to the Late Late Show's YouTube channel than watch the Late Late Show.
Well,
they
and
don't
I,
get
I
3
would,
million viewers a night. I'm telling you that.
Well, and I would argue that more people subscribe to it than actually watch it on YouTube. In other words,
well,
they're subscribed so that when
too.
They go
of course,
to YouTube.
Of course, it, of course.
Yeah.
We know that. We understand. You don't have to posit that as if it's, you know, a tentative suggestion. Of course, it's true. People subscribe and they never watch it again sometimes. Nonetheless, I'm just saying more people bothered to click on that and say, I want to subscribe than even watch the damn show nightly.
Well, you know, there was the old saying. I think it was Chris Rock said it. He said, you know what? This was during the Conan O'Brien, Jay Leno debacle over at NBC. Mm-hmm. He said, if more people actually watched Conan O'Brien on The Tonight Show than talked about watching Conan O'Brien on The Tonight Show, we wouldn't
be
talking
about it.
Exactly.
Right. I'm just interested in how this monetizes. 630 million views is a lot. You got ads on it. I'm sure you're making some money, but how much?
Actually, it was David Alan Greer that said that. So
all right.
Credit where credit is due. All right. So from late night to streaming music, according to the New York Times, Pandora is up for sale. The company has been working with Morgan Stanley to meet with potential buyers. The company is currently valued at $1.8 billion, which sounds like a lot, but it's way down from $8 billion, which it was worth a short while ago.
I hate when that happens.
With more and more competitors nipping at their heels. On the bright side, the royalty rate of their type of service, their kind of it's non on demand, so it's like a radio. Well, that royalty rate was set at a new level that wasn't nearly as expensive as Pandora had originally feared. And the company has been expanding with purchases of Ticketfly and others. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, right? It's one of the big players in streaming music, and they're in play. Does somebody want to buy them and put them out of business? Do they see it as a good long-term business model? What's the deal? I don't know.
I don't know, but with the amount of money that Apple has on hand just, you know, lying around, they could literally pick
up
the tab.
But if it dropped by 75%, why bother paying $2 billion just to shut it down? It seems to be on the way down anyway.
Oh, you mean just like continue to watch
it? Why spend money to shut down something that's already lost 75% of its value?
Well, you would do that basically so that nobody else could have it.
See it as a threat if it's not working as a business model? Is it a good long-term business model? Their new royalty rate is better, but are people flocking to Pandora when they can't play the music on demand that they want? I don't know.
I mean, I know that I know a lot of people listen to Pandora. That much I know.
All right.
Bruce Springsteen, you know I'm a big fan, Michael, but he better be able to sell a lot more books than albums. And here's why. Simon & Schuster just paid $10 million for Born to Run, which I don't know why they paid so much. I mean, that album has been out for decades. It's a memoir by Springsteen about his childhood and early days as a rock and roller. He's been writing the book since 2009, and it's due out on September 27th in the US, Canada, the UK, Australia, and in India. His last two albums haven't even gone gold, and it's been more than a decade since a CD of Bruce Springsteen's went platinum. One thing is certain, though. The book tour is going to kick ass. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for fans of Bruce Springsteen. It's a lot of money. It's a big bet, frankly. Obviously, he's a much bigger star than album sales of recent years. Hundreds of thousands of people flock to see him in concert every year. But, you know, I was intrigued by where they purchased it for. Basically, this is an English language rights buy.
Yes.
Basically, they said, we're going to buy it for the English market. US, Canada, UK, Australia, and India. That means pretty much, you know, it's one more step before they just start buying language rights to books, because that's almost what they did here.
Well, it's not almost what they did. It's pretty much exactly what they did.
Well, but I believe people can have the rights, though they don't bother to put out an English language version in, you know, China. If they buy that market, they can do Mandarin, Cantonese, and Chinese. You know, there's territories with many, many languages in them. And India is not just English, of course. There are many people in India, you know, there are many languages in India. It's a good growing market for books. So they will be putting it into other languages for the Indian market. Canada, they will be putting it in French, make it for French Canadian citizens available. So it's not a pure language buy, but they're getting there and it's going to be pretty soon. And you can see why they're hopeful. Bookstore sales finally went up this year. It's the first time in 8 years that sales in the U.S. bookstores actually rose. They had $11 billion, $11,170,000,000, and that's up from the $10,890,000,000 of a year ago. Now, if you look back to the last time that they actually rose from the year before, that was 2007, bookstore sales were $17 billion. So we're still way down from 17, you know, $11 billion is a far cry from $17 billion. And they also don't detail in the stories where they're making money and what's happening, what's rising. Is it games, calendars, toys, or is it actually books? So nonetheless, better to go up than down.
Now, Dish offered TV viewers, Dish is a satellite television provider here. They offer TV viewers the laziest option ever. No need to fast forward or jump through commercials. Auto hop. Remember the hopper? It would auto hop, would do it for you. Fox fought them on it. The network Fox. They fought Dish on this in the courts and they finally settled before litigation goes any further. The winner? Fox. The loser? TV shows and viewers. Dish has agreed to disable the auto hop option until 7 days after a TV show is aired. Since Live Plus 7 is the metric networks get paid for, that seems to make sense. Is it possible some viewers will simply wait 7 days and then use AutoHop? Yeah, it is. This also means a Fox and Dish dispute over retransmission may soon be settled as well. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for Dish users, right? It's a shame it didn't go to court because I think it would be an interesting case whether they have the right to do that, to take a TV network stream, but cut out all the ads, which is what they're doing. So it would be an interesting case. I'd love to have seen some precedent, but I think it's going to mess with you. I think that all long term, doesn't that make you kind of want to ditch your Dish?
Well, you know, at the end of the day here, I think
if that's the only reason you're getting them, right?
Yeah, I think Fox didn't want to see a precedent set because if it was set the other way, they could be screwed.
I assume that they're going to disable it for everyone, not just Fox.
I couldn't get clarity.
But
once you have it for Fox, I mean, every retransmission agreement will have it in there.
Okay.
Now, two shows are headed to Broadway. Okay.
Hamilton.
Well, that's already on Broadway.
All right.
One is no surprise at all, while the other is a bit of a shocker. First, it's the Disney musical Frozen. It's going to play out of town in 2017 and then hit the Great White Way in 2018.
Buy your tickets now.
We knew that, of course. What we didn't know was that producer Scott Rudin has been negotiating for the rights to produce one of the most famous properties in history, but to produce it on Broadway. Yes, what we're talking about here is To Kill a Mockingbird. It's coming to New York. It's been produced regionally and in Harper Lee's Monroeville, Alabama, many times in a stolidly faithful to a fault version. But Rudin has signed up a guy, you may know him. His name is Aaron Sorkin, to do a proper adaptation that is aiming for New York in the 2017-2018 season. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal for both of them. Disney's on fire. Aladdin is a big, big hit. That is just doing gangbusters. And it's a fun show. So they've really had a lot of success on Broadway. Not always. You know, Tarzan didn't work. Little Mermaid didn't work. But more often than not, they are raking it in. And Frozen is going to be a monster. So that'll be fascinating to see. But To Kill a Mockingbird, oh my God. Obviously, none of this would have happened. They would have not have put out the rough draft slash earlier novel, Ghost at a Watchman, and they would not be taking To Kill a Mockingbird if she was in full control of her faculties.
No, I completely agree. Is there
any doubt of that? No. For 50 years, she does nothing. Suddenly, now that she's frail, her sister is dead, there's questions of her mental acuity, and suddenly now she's signing off left and right on things. Give me a break. But it would have all happened 5 years from now anyway.
That's true.
The state would have done it after. Nonetheless, there's a certain tackiness to the whole thing, I think.
I mean, she's still alive.
She's still alive. And you know it's not what she would have wanted. I don't care if you met with her. Give me a break. But on the other hand, and now I'm going to get a phone call from Scott Rudin. On the other hand, a couple other quick Broadway notes. Fun milestones this past week. School of Rock hit 80 performances, which is no big deal. But Aladdin hit its 800th performance. And Chicago hit its 8,000th performance all in the same week. So that was kind of cool. And Wicked passed Rent to become the 10th longest running show in Broadway history.
Wow, all of that in one week.
And I still haven't seen it.
You still haven't seen Wicked?
No, I want to see it.
I actually saw it recently again, and I was like, wow, the first act was really good. Yeah, first act. Good.
Oh, well.
Yeah, okay. Now, here's the thing. Don't mess with Han Solo. Actor Harrison Ford broke a leg when a prop malfunctioned on the set of Star Wars in the UK. Now, after an investigation, the British government has filed criminal charges citing four violations of workplace health and safety laws. Named in the suit? Producers on the film. Glad to have been sitting at home counting his money? George Lucas. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, I guess, in the scheme of things. We'll have to find out exactly what they failed to do, what safety measures weren't taken. It's nice to know that even Star Wars, which has a long history of filming in the UK, isn't above the law. But, you know, I'm not sure what happened. It'd be nice to know. Maybe we'll find out whether it was negligence or, you know, accidents happen. But, you know, it's a film set. People should not get injured and killed on a film set just because you're making a movie. So, you know, if the info comes out, and we find out what went on. That will be interesting.
Well, of course, Star Wars isn't above the law. I mean, everybody knows the only people who are above the law are senators that are debating the nomination of a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah.
Straight out of Compton, the TV series? Not quite, but Apple has plunged into original content. Dr. Dre is executive producing and starring in a semi-autobiographical TV series called Vital Signs, a 6-episode dive into television that sounds more like the animated film Inside Out. So what is he, like, playing a pre-adolescent girl? And I don't know. Per The Hollywood Reporter, each episode focuses on a different emotion and how Dre's character deals with it. It's a dark drama, and other actors involved include Sam Rockwell. Big deal or big whoop?
And I should say, it's not exactly like Inside Out, since apparently one episode has an orgy.
Yes,
so
that's how that's
not exactly for the kids.
Apparently, you put a whole bunch of naked people out on the street, naked extras out on the street, and somebody goes, what's that for? What do you mean they're filming a Dr. Dre television series? For who?
Yes.
For Apple?
And guess who's that on the set? His wife.
Yes.
She was there that day.
Yes. He wasn't, though. He was not. Did you notice Dr. Dre was not? But the wife was.
He said, I'll be there. I'll make sure they look good.
Yeah, exactly. Don't worry, Dre. We got
it's
this.
It's a big deal because, you know, if Apple wants Apple TV to get an audience, one great thing it can do, of course, they want a mini package. They want a thin bundle of the channels people really want, the 15 or 20 channels they're dying for, and they want original content.
Well, if you look at Netflix, right? I mean, that's exactly what they did. They said, okay, so you're not going to give us your content? Here's what we're going to do. We're going to actually...
Well, they got tons of content.
We're going to make our content, but we're going to make our own content better than yours. And that's what they did. And
they
now
had
people,
tons of content.
Right, but now the only place you can get, you know, whether it's Orange is the New Black or House of Cards, you have to go to Netflix. You got to be a Netflix subscriber.
But Netflix was not denied content. They
No, absolutely not. But I mean, what was the reason to subscribe? One reason was
TV show reruns and movies.
Right.
And now slowly it's become because they've got shows you want to see. It's just like HBO. They had movies.
That's right.
Now they have originals.
So Apple's
doing the same.
I was going to say taking a song from the same playbook, but, you know, Apple Music. So, okay. Viacom's earnings, well, they're bad enough. But now, new CEO for real, Philip DeMann, made it worse by acting as if the facts of the company's poor performance were just, you know, like rumors or gossip with no basis in reality. This is a quote. Our outlook and the facts have been distorted and obscured by the naysayers, self-interested critics, and publicity seekers, Mr. DeMann said in a conference call.
He should have sounded angrier.
Okay, well, he went on to say, we will not be distracted or deterred as we build for the bright future ahead of us. End quote. You go, Philip. Viacom stock fell 21% in trading after that performance, not to mention the actual figures, which were not all that great. It has fallen 51% in the past year. Big deal or big whoop?
There's a lot of media stocks. Of course, there's an overall fall in the stock market, but it looks like media stocks in particular are facing an actual, maybe a correction or a bear market. Who knows? If you look at what they are down from August, I guess that was the last quarterly earnings announcement. Is that why they're mentioning August?
Well, that would be, probably.
They're comparing
August.
What
would have been September? So
they're comparing August to mid-February, and they're saying Viacom was down overall like 36% in that period. And of course, as we just said, it's 51% overall. Time Warner was down 31% as of February 10th. Fox was down 29%. Disney was down 27%. Sony was down 25%. CBS down 19%, on and on and on. What I want to get is Twitter. They hit their lowest closing price ever, though they rebounded slightly after that recently. But they did hit their lowest closing price ever. And they announced that their revenue was up and it hit $650 million. It was up 48% over the revenue from the same quarter last year. right?
This is what makes no sense.
48%.
Right.
But like, they're not adding enough Twitter users. People aren't using it. And it's like, what do they expect? You can't have exponential growth from now until the end of time and people adding on your service.
Right. I mean, what's wrong with just making more money?
Yeah, I mean, 48, right, exactly. You've got a business, you've developed it, and now you're making lots of bucks, like increasing your revenue 48%, and it hits a low? It doesn't make any sense to me.
On the same day, you see, but it's all perception, right? And this is where...
This is why I don't play the stock market.
Right, the stock market is actually gambling, in a way, because you're... although
it's... do it like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's educated gambling, in a way, that actually has some numbers behind it, supposedly. But here, just like you said, Twitter beat analysts' expectations. They made money, more money than the same quarter of the year before, and their stock price falls.
50% more. Right. It wasn't like they modestly grew. Right. 48% increase in revenue.
That's, oh, well. And it fell because they said, oh, and by the way, we had the same number of users quarter over quarter. So
only 300 gazillion.
320 million, yeah. Meanwhile,
320 million users. Losers.
Meanwhile, you had Tesla saying, we lost more money than analysts were expecting. Okay, so we actually lost a lot of money. And on guidance, we're going to tell you we're going to lose money again in probably the next couple quarters. So
don't expect
the stock goes through the roof. Why? Because the perception is more and more people are buying those cars. Therefore, they will make more and more money. So they're losing money now, but they'll make money later. Buy now, buy low, basically.
That's
the concept there. Now, speaking of stocks, hey, you know what? Here's a stock that everybody loves, Amazon. For the most part, per The Guardian, and this is a quote, and I love this. This is a great EULA edition. Okay, in their EULA,
what's a EULA?
End user license agreement. Those little things that you click, I agree, and without
that
reading,
I never read.
Yes, that's a big problem, and I'm sure at some point will be taken up in some form of legislation, but not right now. So in Amazon's EULA, they say Amazon's web services arm has updated its terms of service with a special clause. Clause 57.10 of the AWS Terms of Service states, the restriction will not apply in the event of the occurrence, certified by the United States Centers for Disease Control or successor body, of a widespread viral infection transmitted via bites or contact with bodily fluids that causes human corpses to reanimate and seek to consume living human flesh, blood, brain, or nerve tissue, and is likely to result in the fall of organized civilization.
End quote.
How a game engine is likely to help on what is presumably short notice of an outbreak that reanimates corpses is unknown. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I'll give it to you.
Well, I'm going to say it's a big whoop, obviously, but it's very, very funny that they would do this knowing that people usually don't read these things, okay? So they throw this stuff in there and it's like, well, were you reading? It's been there for a year, okay? Nobody said anything. But you know, look, just
at least someone's having fun.
Yeah, as a side note, guess what? You know who? Where all of Netflix's content is stored? All of it?
Amazon Web.
AWS, Amazon Web Services. That's right.
And by the way, you've just been replaced by a drone.
Oh, really?
Sorry. But not James Levine.
No. Actually, they're trying to figure out how they replace him. Now, you might be wondering, who is James Levine? Well, okay. He is the conductor for the Metropolitan Opera, who is looking towards the future right now. He is the famed conductor of that organization. His name is James Levine, and he has been plagued by health issues for years. But everyone wants to make sure he can go out on his own terms without damaging the legacy of what he's accomplished since the Ford administration, since the 1970s. He basically turned this company around.
It was a poor orchestra, not doing a lot, and he made it into a world-class orchestra. He made them a center for Wagner productions. He did bold new productions. I mean, he is literally the face of the Met and has made it the world-class organization that it is today.
Right. He's one of the, it's the biggest performing arts organization in the United States. Okay, that's what the Met is. And it's one of the gold standards of opera. Now, in fact, a retirement announcement was literally a day or two away from being published when Levine's doctor announced out of the blue that recent problems that Levine was facing may be due to the high dosage of his medication as opposed to the underlying medical issues of his Parkinson's disease.
Like literally 24 hours before they were going to announce this.
Yeah, well, so that's been put on hold, his retirement, that is, while they see what this change in medication regimen will mean for Levine's ability to conduct. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for the Met, a big whoop for everyone else. I you know, the Times had it very as if it was all tension and horrible, and it seems they're all kind of on the same page. You know, he's been there for 50 years. They want him to go out in a proper way. They don't want to push him out. They don't want him to go out weekly. If he can, you know, they want him involved in some way until the day he drops dead. You know, it's not like he's not going to be involved, you know, come tomorrow. So it's nice to see that they're being forthright about the issues. It's obvious, you know, he's a year or two and he's missed his performances sometimes. So everybody's on the same page. They're trying to do it the right way. Hopefully it'll all work out for the best.
Yeah, well, and he just canceled an appearance at the Philadelphia Orchestra, which I think may not be because of it. Well, he said it was because of health, but I think it might be more because it looks like that particular orchestra's music director, Yannick Nezet-Séguin, has been kind of he's the unspoken
heir apparent.
Heir apparent, thank you. He's the heir apparent for James Levine, and it's like, well, maybe I won't show up there because I'm not actually leaving right now. I do think it's interesting though that literally the New York Times, a reporter from the New York Times, went to the doctor's appointment with James Levine,
and the head of the Met,
and Peter Gelb, the head of the Met, and they basically all kind of sat around and talked about it, you know, like very openly and like, okay, well, I've got this part.
Behaving like adults, they're all.
I think that is absolutely fantastic, and I wish everybody would behave this way.
Like the government.
No. Senators, take note. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I have to admit, this week we cheated a little because this isn't Inside Baseball. The Grammys are, of course, a world-renowned institution, a world-renowned show, and it's one of my favorite shows every year is the one we do after the Grammys because we always get to talk to David Wilde. And David is, of course, he's an Emmy-nominated television writer for writing at the Grammys, but he's also a contributing editor at Rolling Stone. He writes books. And I believe, David, your latest book is Diary of a Player that you wrote with Brad Paisley. David, thank you for joining us.
Hey, no, I'm happy to be here.
Well, congratulations on the ratings. About 25 million people watched last night in the overnights. It ties last year, which was down from before, about a six-year low, but it was on a Monday night. As opposed to Sunday, which is typically a lower viewing night. You were live on both coasts. It's still a huge, huge event. So it's the importance of live events are increasing for networks. So I'm sure everybody's heaving a sigh of relief and glad to know that people tuned up again.
Yeah, the Monday thing, I think I felt like I was more worried than other people because I know when I've done other award shows that are very tied to one night, it can be confusing. People are very used to that Sunday night thing. But I think, yeah, with everything considered, I'm very happy that, you know, it was music's biggest night and so very big.
Well, and in fact, first off, I want to ask why it was on Monday. But in fact, when I reached out to you to see if you might be available the day after the Grammys, I said, would you be available Monday? And you said, well, no, not really, because the Grammys are on Monday.
So, exactly.
Because I just...
Yeah, no, it was tied, I think, to facts, you know, just about the holiday, the Valentine's Day, the Super Bowl and CBS having the Super Bowl this year, so that the weekends are limited in this season, and that's where we had to go, and it worked out pretty well.
You know, the Grammys, have they ever won an Emmy for writing? I think, of course, people think of the music. They forget that there's a lot of writing going on. What was your favorite line that you were able to work into the show? We're always watching for the segues from one artist to another or the call-outs to albums or classic songs. What was your favorite little nugget you got to get to the show?
Well, actually, you know, this year my favorite thing was not a nugget, but it was writing for Don Cheadle to introduce that incredible performance by Kendrick Lamar. He's exactly who I would have wanted to do it. And the way it works is, you know, you write something and then you work with them. But this was a case where I guess I feel slightly bad saying, but he just wrote back, "This is great." And I said, "Well, that's a good review." And his reading of anything, he's, you know, one of my favorite actors. I thought I wanted someone as with his intelligence and, credibility to sort of lay out a little bit of Kendrick's story. And I think he did a great job. So for me, that was a highlight. I'm a fan.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me, and I may have said this in years past, but I once heard Branford Marsalis compare playing with Sting to a... Well, I didn't compare. He just said it was very difficult because you only get a few seconds as a saxophonist to do a solo. It's not like jazz.
You know, that's sort of like the Grammys, because Ken Ehrlich, our executive producer, does jam it so full of music that, you know, you can't generally cut the songs, so you have to cut words. So, yeah, it's I try to squeeze in as much story and theme as possible. And, you know, in some ways that people wouldn't even notice, like, you know, when LL started the night, he said something about that music creators' heroes have come together on the stage if just for just for one day, which to me is an echo of Heroes, my favorite Bowie song. So
yeah,
I try to, yeah, we heard, you know, that. And I think in little words like, yeah, so these are things I do for myself in hopes that they get across messages that we want to resonate. The main thing is the show to me is an annual celebration of the place of music in our lives. And it's, frankly, it's an important rallying point for the music community, which with all the changes in the economics of music, it's important to sort of take, you know, a real stand on music's biggest night for underlining and underscoring the value of music in people's lives.
In fact, Neil Portnow, he did actually, and he is the head of the RIAA, which throws the big party. He's the head of the group that puts on the Grammys.
He's the head of the Academy.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Yes. I'm getting everything wrong today.
Oh, yeah, the Recording Academy.
Yeah. He mentioned that, and he talked about how, you know, when you stream music, the artists only get, well, they get a fraction of a penny. And did you have to write that speech for him? And he gave it with Common, the hip hop artist Common. And it was a very, I thought it stated very well. Was that something that you worked with him on?
That's Neil, you know, really works on his own statement, and then we'll sit down and I'll try to help in any way in shaping what he wants to do. That's one of the, you know, that is Neil's statement. He's a man with his own very, you know, firm commitment to music. I work with him, but that is Neil's, his statement for the year.
What I want to know is how you work in a scripted compliment to a performance that hadn't happened yet. Because you had Anna Kendrick saying, "What a powerful performance we just heard from the Eagles." Clearly a scripted line. We knew it was going to be a powerful performance, of course, because you saw them perform in the afternoon. And you only do that once or twice. Sometimes you say, "Here comes a Grammy moment." But in this case, you had her complimenting a performance that we had just seen, even though it was clearly a scripted thing. You depend on the person to be natural and let it come across and be sincere. Or how does that work?
The way that worked was because we were going from the performance at the end of one act by the Eagles and Jackson Browne paying tribute to Glenn to the top of the next act. We were mentioning, because we mentioned certain honors that the Academy bestows every year, including one that Irving Azoff was winning, their longtime manager. So just to make a transition, I told her why we were doing it, and that if she liked the performance, that line was in there to bridge from after, because the performance was before the commercial, to sort of remind people we just saw this performance into, you know, honoring Irving Azoff. That was,
oh, I see,
how that worked. But I always say, I don't want you to say anything you don't think. I don't, I cut anything anyone questions, and we listen to their ideas and embrace them, and, you know, I'll steal from anyone.
Who had the best idea this year?
Me, definitely.
Well, you may be wondering, you know, why aren't we mentioning all the winners? I mean, you could get the winners anywhere. Taylor Swift won Album of the Year, and
hell, you only gave away 8 on air.
Yeah, okay, so let's start there. 8 awards. I guess that is a kind of, is that an all-time low? It seems like it would be an all-time low.
I think we've been right in the 10-9 area for a decade now, I think. The reason the show's also done incredibly well in that period, because I think Ken has sort of, you know, come to terms with the fact that in addition to being about the awards, it is about the performances, and that it's a television event. And as much as, you know, I like to write a lot of copy about a lot of awards, that, you know, the way the show is booked with, you know, so many incredible nominees along with other artists, it just leaves less time for a lot of talk and a lot of awards. Now, we try to honor a wide variety, from the Lifetime Achievement honorees, you know, so, but literally comes down to having to pick and choose. And I know for a fact that, you know, it's Ken is the executive producer. I'm just, you know, one of the co-producers and, you know, and a writer. But I think people don't realize, like, when you see some of the talk about what is on the show and what is not, it's like, it is very hard to make, with the music world that's as diverse as, you know, as music is, Ken has to build a big TV event every year. And that comes down to making tough choices, you know. And I mean, like, for instance, this year with, you know, we had so many legends who passed away in the last, you know, 2 months. Those decisions that Ken and Neil and, you know, the team has to make, it's very difficult. I mean, for instance, you know, Ken goes back to Chicago with Maurice White, and, you know, he was probably of the significant icons, the most recent death. And, you know, we're at a point, the way these shows work, you're confirming artists, you know, along the way. So by, you know, the time you got to when Maurice passed, and, you know, I'm the biggest Earth, Wind & Fire fan I know, but at a certain point, you have a time limit on the show, and you have confirmed so many performers. So I thought, like, for instance, that I was extremely happy with, you know, the fact that we asked Stevie and, you know, to work with Pentatonix on that kind of musical moment. And I thought it was really beautiful. And that's the thing, you have to find different ways to do it. It's, you know, it's extremely easy for people in the outside to just literally rattle off a list of why didn't you do this and this and this.
Because there's only, like, 3 hours.
Right. And people do not understand that that means something else that you feel should be and would be cut. And you can't do things the same way. You know, I think, like, it just comes down to trying to do a wide range of moments so that, you know, to do the kind of ambitious, high-tech thing that Gaga did for David Bowie, then to me, you want that on a show next to something like Chris Stapleton, Bonnie Raitt, and Gary Clark Jr. just doing
the song.
Just doing the song with, you know, with the special effect with the guitar playing and the singing. So it just, you know, it's variety TV in the old terms. And I think Ken and Neil and the team, I think they, you know, we, but they do a remarkable job of bringing real variety to the show.
Is it feeling more high stakes and tense in recent years? I mean, the value of live television as programming has just grown and grown. The ratings may be slightly more modest, but given the landscape of 500 channels and on demand, those 25 million people are huge in this day and age compared to what TV shows are getting. Is the network or everybody involved, are they just more tense and, like, hands-on, or are they, thank God you're doing this and doing a good job, and they're less hands-on?
No, I mean, I think everybody...
Is it getting harder or easier?
I think it gets harder for, I guess, a number of reasons, including the changing nature of the music industry, which, you know, the way artists make money, the financial, fiscal realities of music it's a pretty ambitious, you know, undertaking to, you know, to mount this kind of show. So that gets more challenging. That's not my job particularly, or my focus. But I think, my general feeling is, like, you know, listen, I work on so many of these events, and I feel like as a society, I think these are some of the, you know, the events are more and more important. But the other thing that sort of happens at the same time with that is in the nature of social media, and the nature of media with the sort of collapse of sort of old school print,
jobs.
jobs and old school print. And I'm a recovering rock critic, so I know about that. And with all that, I think, unfortunately, in the social media age, you only get attention for being negative. So, you know, that's, in fact, that thing that was coming up with artists backstage last night, and not even people who were having and being criticized, but they said, it is just such an ugly age because you really get, criticized for doing anything. I mean, that's going to be the most retweeted thing is the sort of snark. And I guess being around the side of it that I'm on, and again, I'm a music critic, so I understand that, but I think that the thing I don't get is, I think as a society, we do need to focus more on honoring. Like, I could talk for an hour about Bonnie Raitt, Gary Clark, and Chris Stapleton. You know, it's like, you know, the king of the blues dies, and you have a guy who's a country breakout star. You have a real sort of blues guitarist who's kind of taking things in a further direction. And you have a woman who's, you know, the daughter of a great Broadway great who somehow has become, you know, the most, I think, greatest continuity between Ruth Brown, who she spoke about last night, into music today, a woman who just understands the blues and roots. A woman whose roots are showing, as I always like to joke.
And we're talking about Bonnie Raitt, who has gray hair,
I just think I'd like to hear more about that than, like, I don't really care personally about Kanye, you know, Kanye gets more attention for asking for money. Obviously, I mean, I think that's sort of a downside even for art. Like, does Kanye really need to get attention with Taylor Swift again?
You know, yeah, like, I thought the same thing.
So because it's a live show, there's lots of drama because it's just inevitable. Rihanna, of course, had a medical issue and couldn't perform. When did you guys find out, and did you replace her, or did you just say, hey, guess what? We got a full show anyway.
That was one of the more difficult things we've ever had to deal with because she did dress rehearsal.
Ooh.
And so we were, I have my text that I'm looking at, which is the way I was backstage with the presenters and, you know, like less than an hour before the show when I got the word. And literally for the next hour and a half, people don't understand how TV really works. It's not just, you can't just say, okay, she's not here. There are so many little
moving parts.
I mean, literally there was her staging for her bit that was up and rigged above in Staples Center, you know,
right.
You can't just
disappear.
There's a pure math to how they have to get the staging of these numbers done and how it's all sort of worked out. So everything for me, like bumpers need to be changed. You know, James Corden has spoken about it. He was part of her performance and he's there and he's, you know, he's great. So I'm like backstage with James and LL and James' producer from his show. And we're working out, okay, let's put him in the Lionel Richie thing. And then, you know, I sort of like take the three paragraphs of the Lionel Richie intro, which we need again. It's like people don't quite get that. Like when there's a long intro, it's usually because to get the stage ready,
you need
45 seconds. So, you know, it's like, okay, LL, you take the first paragraph, James, you take the second paragraph. But then because they're both great guys, it's like, LL was going to do the sort of lyrics from All Night Long. And then James said, I'll repeat it like the song Play On, Play On. And then I was like, and, you know, LL, then you say Mighty Mighty like in Brick House. And so, you know, it ends up being fun, but it was no fun trying to adjust to that. there was literally Lauryn Hill. I believe she came a minute and a half. She arrived back from, again, she was at dress rehearsal. She arrived back a minute and a half after her performance.
Oof.
Which I don't know how to explain some of these things, and it's not for me to explain it, but I will say that the way I think of it is my wife was just attending the show and she was there 2 hours early. So I think it's curious to me how you could be performing and not be there.
Well, maybe she thought it was delayed. Like, you know, like and then years past, maybe she had it on Sunday like me.
And I'm pretty sure she was well informed, but no.
You give out awards in the afternoon, an awards ceremony. Where does everyone go in between?
You're asking the wrong guy because I am never at that. I am in the lower level of Staples Center waiting to hear what happens there and then having to adjust the script because that's like one of the many of the millions of moving parts is, you know, you need to change the script to reflect people who've won.
Right.
So that, and update numbers of wins and things like that. And that's you have to build this is my fantastic script supervisor who builds this sort of grid so that we can get that done. But it's there's a lot of tension that way, but there's also a lot of joy because they were mainly a team that's done this for years and we enjoy each other. And then we're sitting listening to some of the greatest music on earth. And that's a good gig.
Well, now one of the biggest, I want to say, blocks of the night. It wasn't just one performance. It was like almost a set of performances that all played off of one another. Was when you went live to New York via satellite to the Richard Rodgers Theater, where the cast of Hamilton performed their opening number. It was at around the 9:30 p.m. mark on the East Coast, so an hour and a half into the show. What was that like, getting that right and having to write that for? Did you have to write that for the Stephen Colbert intro? Was Stephen Colbert introed it?
Yes. No, that was Ken told me we were doing Hamilton, which I was completely thrilled about. And then I proposed for the monologue that we set that up because it was so unique. I thought, let's use that uniqueness. And to make it more fun, I suggested we ask Colbert, who agreed to do it, and he had me write a version that he looked at it and sort of, you know, took, he basically did most of what we asked him and couldn't have been nicer about it. And he was great. You know, it was just a way to also incorporate him. He's been on, you know, we had him on our show to do like a minute or two of jokes a couple of years ago, and working with him was great. So I'm a fan and wanted him to be a part of the show. We wanted James Corden. We want to just bring as many of these great voices, you know, into our show.
Well, I have a technical question about that. Three different families mentioned on their own without me asking that they were watching the Grammys just to watch that performance because their kids love the show or they love the cast. They haven't seen the show. It's their first chance to actually glimpse this show. And that's kind of amazing when you think about it. But they did a great job of playing to the camera as opposed to keeping it big and broad for a Broadway house. And they really were comfortable with the camera. Most of those people have never done work in front of a camera, probably much, if at all, the theater people. Did they have extra rehearsal in the afternoon or just the usual one rehearsal? Was working out having a camera on stage and they're blocking it? I thought it was really interesting.
This is like a month of work, not by me, but by, there was a lot of thought that worked and work that went into it. And I thought it played beautifully.
It worked brilliantly. Yeah,
beautifully.
It was terrific.
Well, and then right after, that was one of the highlights of the night for me, at least. Then you went into what is for many the big highlight of the night. So that theatrical performance to another theatrical performance right there at the Staples Center was Kendrick Lamar doing this
production. And just to show you how that sort of thing works, you might have noticed that Kendrick's performance was on both stages.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons that it worked powerfully, but it also there's technical reasons for so many of these things. We needed that Hamilton performance in New York to get that stage ready for Kendrick, because that was quite a wild stage. And, you know, it took exactly that much time to get that ready. But I thought they worked together as powerful as they, and that's also what I tried to, working with LL, we both, you know, he is a guy who, as big as mainstream star as he is through TV, he is one of, and this is something that I can't believe people forget it, but, you know, I'm the right age to remember when he
made Love.
He and Run DMC basically got the whole thing going. They were like the first superstar. So to me, it was cool in the open to actually have set up Hamilton, which is a different kind of moment for hip hop and on Broadway, to acknowledge Run DMC and to then go right to Ice Cube and his son and to acknowledge Straight Outta Compton and sort of in a variety of ways show how hip-hop is now such a central and significant force.
I was fascinated by the editing that was done, the technical stuff on Kendrick Lamar. They did some
that
very fierce editing right towards the end that was very unusual for a live performance.
I'll tell you, I loved it, absolutely loved it as well. To me, there was an interesting, for me, that had just an interesting resonance because, you know, David Bowie loved Kendrick. His last record was inspired by Kendrick. And I knew Bowie very well, or quite well, for years. And I know, and to me, that face sort of editing move almost had a sort of connection to like the David Bowie video stuff that I've seen.
Yes.
So I think That was very, very interesting. I loved it. I thought the entire performance was brilliant.
Well, during that performance, and you know, if there's a bit of controversy that everybody looks for in a performance, I guess there was a moment there where the audio fell out and it seemed like the performance was censored. Now, of course, Kendrick Lamar's album is, you know, it has some profane words in it. So was that planned? Because I guess there was a lot of people saying now, well, that lyric didn't even have a profane word in it. Or was that just somebody accidentally leaning against the mute button? What happened there?
I haven't seen the show. I just, you know, we worked on it and I've been hiking or with Adam Carolla and now you since. So have not. And tonight I'm going to watch the show. I didn't know that that had happened. I assume it was because there was a word that, you know, CBS heard. I literally don't know. I think the point is, you know, I think Kendrick was going to, it's a guy who speaks his mind and, you know, so I don't think he's going to pull back anything. So I'll look into it, but I have no idea.
You know, when during that performance, I actually thought, gee, I wonder where David is because there's so much fire on stage now. It seems like it would be scorching.
Yeah, no, you know, it was hot. It was extremely hot. It was a hot night. It was hot on that red carpet here. But, you know, for me, it was very warm. But no, I'm right below him. In fact, I'm probably exactly where that bonfire was. That's where I was underneath there.
Oh, wow.
About 8 feet.
Well, it's the hip hop album has only won the album of the award twice. And the last time was 11 years ago with Outkast in 2004. But the show is cast by the nominees. So you must have been kind of thrilled when you saw how the five albums of the year worked out because you had Taylor Swift with pop, Alabama Shakes with alternative rock, Kendrick Lamar with hip hop, Chris Stapleton with country, and The Weeknd with R&B and dance. So, I mean, it just was a great mix of music. You know, there was not like three rock albums or anything like that. You had no problems with balance because they all got to perform. And then the record and song of the year turned out to be a classic illustration of the difference between the two. Record of the year was Uptown Funk, a great record, though you don't want to hear a lot of people cover it. And the song of the year was a standard by Ed Sheeran, Thinking Out Loud, that people might sing for years to come.
Yeah, I you know, we don't write the winners, but when they work out, I like to see the love spread. Although, interestingly, I think for ratings, my memory is that historically years where someone has a big sweep and that story builds throughout a night, like Norah Jones that year, I remember.
Yes.
They say that those sort of things help ratings, but it's, you know, it's all a mystery to me. All you can do is, you know, Ken puts on the... And the Academy put on the best show they can every year out of the nominees. And then there's always a couple of wild cards. And we just had more wild cards, you know, this year than not. I mean, but I will say it's like this is the same team in large measure that like adjusted to when Whitney Houston died that managed to, you know, pull something together right away that was respectful and dignified. And, you know, so I think. But I did. Everyone after the show was like, "Oh my God, that was probably the toughest hour we've had." Was that first hour just because there were so many moving parts to be realigned?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a great show. And you know what I want to know is why are the commercials on the Grammys better than the commercials on the Super Bowl? I mean,
the Super Bowl were to me they were weak. I am not watching the commercials. I'll watch them tonight. I'm glad to hear that. I know that there was a whole Gwen Stefani thing, right? She did her Target sort of.
Oh, yeah, her live performance, yeah.
I was going to ask if you...
Was that good?
But that was amazing. I was just telling Michael, I wish all commercials would be like that. It was fantastic. I don't know how they did it. I don't know how they pulled it off. I was going to ask if you guys were involved in it. Apparently not, but
no.
Boy, I rewound it and watched it again.
Yeah, great.
Did they get approval? Did you guys tell CBS talk to you about like, is this cool to give a 2.5, 2 minute or whatever to this song? Is this a problem or what was the talk?
That's a question above my pay grade. You know, Ken Ehrlich might know, but I think Jack Sussman at CBS could tell you. But that's ad time. So that's not, there's showtime and ad time. And
oh, sure. But I thought maybe CBS would say, well, wait a second. It's a 2.5 minute ad. Doing a live performance of a song, maybe we should make sure this is cool for everybody. I'm sure they did.
Oh, no, I'm sure they do, but I'm also sure that they were well compensated for this time.
Sure,
I think
of course.
That's a huge buy, and it's, by the way, it seems like it made a positive impact this year, so that only helps us that there's a, you know, musical moment like that.
Well, now, do you get paid extra for all of the tweeting you do at Wild About Music?
I do get asked to do it. I get no compensation other than you know, I will say last night I got great compensation of, you know, selfies with Bruno, my wife, Bruno, me, Ariana Grande. My whole family was bothering Bruno and Ariana. And my favorite photo in years, I just, because I love Earth, Wind, and Fire, as I mentioned. My son, who's a college freshman who came back for the show, loves soul music. And so I got a picture of with Earth, Wind, and Fire. So I call it Earth, Wind, Fire, and Andrew. And I love that photo. Because, you know, so there's moments, but yeah, I'm not getting a lot of compensation for my tweeting, but I do get thank yous. And there were some crazy ones. I was at the rehearsal for the Hollywood Vampires and took a photo of them with Ken. And somehow I put that on Facebook and it seemed to get, like, I don't know what, some crazy number. I think it was the Vampires shared it. So
okay. You know,
I kind of went viral. And I made one joke about Justin Bieber, literally saying there's women cheering for Justin Bieber, or could it be for me, or something like that. And somehow that went everywhere, which was quite amusing.
And your comment about meeting Dave Grohl in the bathroom and how he said, we have to stop meeting like this. And you said, fan or a restraining order.
Oh yeah. That did not go viral. It probably just made Dave uncomfortable. He's the nicest man in the world, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, well, certainly if you're not following David Wild on Twitter, you really need, I say it a lot, but we mention your name often here on the show. You have to follow David Wild on Twitter. It's at Wild About Music. Now, are you working on anything that we should be promoting, pitching, discussing?
Anticipating?
I think in next week or so, I don't know if you guys cover this, but I'm supposed to be helping a little on the Independent Spirit Award, so I'll. My wife just came home. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm on the phone. I'm in a very important showbiz discussion. I'm working on that. So I have a few independent movies to catch up with in the next day or so. But that's good. I need a day or so to relax, because it's just to recover from all the fun of Grammys.
Well, we'll certainly let you get to it. And once again, thank you so much for taking the time, especially right after the Grammys. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you, David.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
That was good of David to stop by and talk to us.
I'm telling you, it's one of my favorite shows that we do every year, because we get to talk to David.
Well, you know, and two of the top albums, Chris Stapleton and Kendrick Lamar, those are on my best of the year list, and I have a link in the show notes. I finally do my annual list of the best albums of the year that I've heard, and I put it up right before the Grammys, so we'll have a link in our show notes. But my favorite album of the year is Sufjan Stevens' Carrie and Lowell. Check it out.
Yeah, I was really surprised that didn't get
get anything. Rolling Stone didn't even have it in their top 50. At least it made the top 10 of the Village Voice Paz and Jop poll. I would have just been flabbergasted if it hadn't.
Well, certainly we'll place links to all of David's Twitter accounts, his Instagram accounts, and his work on Huffington Post, and any work we can find, we will place links to it in our show notes, which can be found at showbizsandbox.com. And that's also where you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, that information, along with all links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as, what else? Our Twitter account, which is @showbizsandbox, or you can find us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up and you can subscribe there. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
Bruce Springsteen, call me and I'll put you on my book filter website.
.com. That's true. If you can't find any of...
If I can't get an interview with Bruce now, I've really screwed up.
That's true. Now he's written a book, for Pete's sake.
Yeah,
it's right in your wheelhouse.
It's going to be very sad if I don't get to talk to him.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's work on whatever that website was, why not try bookfilter.com, or head on over to the Huffington Post, where he covers the entertainment industry, or you can find all of Michael's work aggregated at or collected, so to speak, at michaelgiltz.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.